This is a pre-recorded version of the WTKA Roundtable on WTKA, unsurprisingly, 9 o'clock Thursdays. It is pre-recorded, however, so if you call in, no one will answer.
We got a little early entry into our roundtable segment from Seth Fisher from MGO Blog, who joins us right now. Seth, good morning. How are you?
I got to stop getting out for these sound checks. I just end up on the radio.
You do, but it gives me opportunity to ask you something that we aren't going to probably get to in the roundtable. And that's, have you watched Walter Nolan's film yet? Have you watched any?
Oh, I refuse to. Oh, no. No, I refuse to do that. I made this mistake before. I remember, like, we were all talking about Aubrey Solomon. Is that guy going to commit to Michigan? And I'm like, no way. No way is Michigan going to pull a five-star out of Georgia, right? And then what happens? What happened, Sam? What happened to Aubrey Solomon?
They get him and he leaves. right? That was unfortunate, to say the least, that they... I mean, that was one of a slew. I mean, think about the guys from that. Aubrey Solomon... Deron Irving Bay, of course the lineman who went to Cincinnati to play offensive line,
Hudson,
James, yeah. Hudson, yeah,
James Hudson, all those guys were defensive linemen. Well, how might things have been different if they had come through? But here's the reason why I bring it up. I just watched Walter Nolan down in Florida, down at IMG in this competition, and I've seen a lot of impress. I thought Rashawn Gary was fantastic. Rashawn Gary was a physical freak. He was 6'4". He was 285 pounds or so, and he ran like a 4.68.
Yeah, he literally moved like an NFL linebacker.
Yeah, I mean, you could see he was able to beat guys with sheer athleticism. We just watched Walter Nolan in that competition because he's blessed with outstanding physical talent. He ran a 3-cone drill in 7.03 seconds. I said this on the show earlier this week, that by comparison, a guy like the best defensive player in the game, certainly the best defensive lineman in the game, wouldn't you say? At that time, 6'1", I think he was 285 or 290. Anyway. At that time, back in the 2014 NFL Draft Combine, you had a 3-cone drill time for Aaron Donald of, I think it was 7-1-1. I was trying to come up with the number. All right. Aaron Donald ran a 7-1-1 3-cone drill in 2014 at 285 pounds. Aaron Donald ran it at 310. I'm being generous. In 7.03 as a high schooler. And so you can look at that and say that man is blessed, freaky physical traits, right? Everything he did, Seth, this is what was so impressive to me. Never a bull rush. You watched him break out an arsenal of pass rush moves that was very refined. He had spin. He had swim. He had, you know, he had this rip move that he would do where he would grab a guy and get rid of him and get by. He had all kinds of technique. So while I watched Rashawn Gary be very, very impressive, put on an amazing performance at one of those events, he did it based purely on his physical superiority. This guy went out and dominated every guy in his wake, and it was as much a technical show as it was a physical one. It was one of the most impressive things I've seen.
Yeah, I heard that there was a guy who had not given up a single pressure all game, all camp. and then they put him against Nolan, and Nolan just beat him three times in a row.
Destroyed him. He didn't lose a rep. And the guy you're talking about is Will Campbell. Not Will Campbell.
Not our Will Campbell.
Will Campbell. But the Will Campbell going to LSU, and he got destroyed. Destroyed. And that was the other part, that every rep wasn't close. Like, none of his reps were close. So I get not wanting to watch him.
I could save it. I mean, I did the same thing with Aubrey. I saved it all. I just kept it. I had a little folder of links on my book, on my bookmarks bar for a while, of like, you know, if it happens. And that was what it was called, if it happens. And then once it happened, I went and watched. And look where I am now today, Sam. Look what happened to me.
There are two reasons why I say it's worthy of some attention. It's not worthy of a ton. Like, don't get your hopes too high. But is worthy of some attention because he has family in the area that is really advocating for Michigan. But bigger than that, even, is I know how intent they are on finding out about Michigan's NIL, mm-hmm. NIL outlook. You know, that presentation, they are researching that vigorously. And if Michigan can knock it out of the park with what NIL will look like, because it'll come. It'll be here by at least when is the NIL law around here? I think
for Michigan, I think it's 2022.
Yeah, 2022.
Yeah, we were one of the nice states that were like, here, we'll give you a year to come up with a national program, but we're going to have this. Not one of the southern states that's like, oh, they're going to have this? We better get on that so we can use it in recruiting. God.
Right. So, but for the purposes of Walter Nolan, 2022 is fine. He doesn't get here until.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So. It's one of those deals where a great NIL presentation, I think, puts you even more in play than you are now. Still, again, the South will most likely win this battle. But, man, they got a shot. They have a shot.
I mean, have they met the money cannon? Have they seen the money cannon in action?
I hear you. I understand where you're coming from. But NIL is going to be a money cannon of sorts for someone like him. Maybe not for everyone, but this guy... He's the best player in the country. He's the best. There isn't a high school lineman in this country that can block him one-on-one. I am convinced of that. Is there a college? Yeah, of course. As a freshman, he's going to be blocked. There's going to be some college linemen that can block him one-on-one past his freshman year. I don't think so. He's a freak. He's a freak that has technical refinement. See, Rashawn didn't have that. Rashawn was all power and speed. Right. He didn't have an arsenal of moves coming in. This kid does. And he's going into his senior year of high school. Kind of freaky, kind of scary. But if they get him, he's a game wrecker. He's a game wrecker. Telling you. So
if Jesus. If it happens, going in the if it happens folder.
I hear you. All right. We got to get to a break. We have a bevy of topics, including one that is obviously uncomfortable. But that is still very much in the news, so we're going to talk about it. And welcome back to the Michigan Insiders. Talk to WTKA online at WTKA.com. Sam Webb, Mr. Ira Weintraub on the other side of the county. And you know, 9 o'clock hour. Thursday is dedicated to our friends at MGO Blog. We call it the MGO Blog Roundtable. We talk about a bevy of topics, serious and trivial, mostly serious, though, here of late. With our good friends from MGO Blog, starting off first with Brian Cook. Brian, how are you this morning?
I'm good.
And our good friend Seth Fisher. Seth, how are you this morning? Welcome back, Seth.
Making my folder. Just making my my folder to watch later that I'm never going to watch because I know how things go.
Right. So, guys, press conference yesterday. John Vaughn is the name that most people will be familiar with, but he wasn't alone yesterday in lending voice to many of the allegations of abuse that were in the Wilmer Hale report were anonymous. And we've seen people coming out lending voice to, removing the anonymity. And John Vaughn is the latest football player to do so. I thought he struck a few keynotes, and I want you guys to chime in on these. I think one note he struck was, look, Bo, you know, this conversation being about Bo is missing the point. But on the point of Bo, he's two things to me. He's a guy who did harm to me by not stopping this abuse, but he's also a guy who gave me tools that I use to this day in life. So there's a duality there, a duality of existence there for Bo with me. And then there was that missing the forest for the trees argument. This talk about a statue and about a name on a building misses what the focus should be. And in his eyes and in the eyes of many victims, it should be on them, the victims. Then his last point was a call to action for the regents, a suggestion there that the Wilmer Hill report wasn't thorough enough, isn't detailed enough, doesn't cover all the bases, that the Attorney General's office needs to be involved to uncover some things that weren't covered in the Wilmer Hill report. And I'm curious if you guys gleaned all of that, and what do you make of at least them implying that the Wilmer Hill report was incomplete?
How many different people were referenced in the Wilmer Hill report? Like upwards of 40, I believe.
Okay. I got you. I thought you were talking about
How many people were interviewed and their stories made it into that report?
I gotcha.
So I don't know.
I don't know how many were interviewed. We can say how many made it into the report.
Right. So yeah. I mean, to me, you know, if you want to come out and state these things as a person who has been affected by this, that's great. And those points are mostly well taken. I think that the Wilmer Hale report seems so damning that it's hard to envision that it pulled any punches.
Yeah, I thought the same thing.
So, you know, I feel like, you know, you could make a lot of decisions based on that report and the press conferences. I mean, a press conference is a press conference, right? And we're kind of into the point where plaintiffs' lawyers are making a lot of noise. And to me, I would just stick with what's in the report and make your recommendations based off that. And escalating it to the Attorney General's office, I mean, everybody's dead. Like, it's probably a waste of time for the Attorney General, who has a lot of things to do with people who are not dead, to get involved with this. So obviously there's going to be a settlement, and this feels to me like trying to move numbers in a settlement. And that's not something that I'm particularly interested in. Like, whatever that settlement is, it's just going to be a number and it's going to happen. What I'm interested in is more the fact that, you know, this pattern in the university. So we talk about how everybody's dead with this case, but we have four different recent examples of people who have been in positions of power and have used that to sexually harass people that are current or recently former professors, provosts, that kind of thing. So the thing I would rather we focus on instead of numbers in a settlement is how do we change the structures of power at the university, so when these kind of things happen, they get immediately dealt with instead of 10 or 20 years down the road.
I don't know that you've ever said anything that I agree with more than what you just said. I think you summed up my feelings perfectly, Brian Cook.
Yeah,
Fisher.
I prepped for this, and Brian just said all the points that I kind of wanted to get to. So thanks, Brian. That's our now official statement. You know, yeah, I the only thing to really add is it is nice to be hearing some of the voices that were in the Wilmer Hill report, because you read the report and it's a report, and it's like Brian said, it's damning enough. It feels like they're running the playbook for the Nassar scandal, where that report obviously left things out, and the regents obviously were, you know, twiddling their thumbs and circling the wagons and hiring John Engler and whatnot, which doesn't feel like how the Michigan side is handling it, but we don't know. Michigan is allowed to say what they're actually, you know, what they're doing and how the negotiations are going, because it's a negotiation. They're not allowed to talk about that kind of thing. But it is good, I think, for our standpoint to try to grasp the scandal and grasp how much damage was actually done to these people, to hear them speak. And it's not just hearing from just a few people whose names we've already heard, but was Kathy Callahar, I think, was the woman who said that she was sexually abused in 1973 by Anderson. And she told a therapist at U of M Health who, you know, accused her of having fantasies about Anderson. And I, I, to, the more we hear these stories directly from these people about the culture that existed then, even if it's not the culture that existed now, it shows us what we need to know about institutions and how institutions can harbor somebody like Anderson without anybody being so evil that they're actually trying to, you know, they're not trying to cover him up. But how do you have a guy like that that people aren't trying to cover up but is still able to operate? And it's these institutional failures that happen again and again, and they're not exactly the same institutional failures, but they are similar institutional failures that we've had recently. And those failures need to be addressed structurally, not just case by case.
Yeah, the analogy that I used earlier in the show to sort of crystallize the point that you guys have made so eloquently is, you know, the idea that the Wilmer Hill report isn't thorough enough, that it covered only a portion of all that happened. To me, it's like being I'm not a lawyer, but I talked to Joe Simon, right? <laughs> You know? <laughs> It's like being in a courtroom and him getting up and saying, "Your Honor, we stipulate for the record that everything that these other witnesses are going to say is just like the witnesses that came up before. We concede this point. We stipulate that all of these things are the same." That is not meant to suggest that every instance of abuse isn't important. That is not the suggestion here at all. What it brings up is it necessary to achieve the end? Michigan seems to be, I keep saying seems to be, the Wilmer Hill report is a concession. It is an admission, an acknowledgement that this abuse happened and that we are at fault. By we, I don't mean us. I'm talking about Michigan is saying we are at fault. We had people in positions of authority that allowed this behavior to be perpetuated. That puts us at fault. This is why we're in mediation right now. And so I don't think that you can make that concession be any stronger unless we are to believe in the mediation process that Michigan is in some way being obstructive, some way obfuscating, some way dragging their feet, trying to slow down the process. I don't know any of that, but I'm trying. My assumption is the same one that Brian had, that this is a part of establishing the number. That's how I view it. I don't know that to be true, but it's the reasonable assumption that I come up with, I think, based on the fact that they're saying, yeah, we did it. They're even saying in the report, they're saying that Bo knew. They're saying that Canham knew in the report. That's what they're saying. So all of the things that we're arguing, Michigan officially is conceding.
I'm trying to get around my own biases because I know that I'm a Michigan fan, and my default, if I don't think about it strongly, is going to try to be defending Michigan, defending Bo's legacy. I know that I have that problem, and I'm trying to work around it in order to, you know, see the facts. So one of the questions I keep asking myself is taking it back to the Nasser situation or taking it back to the Paterno situation, where I don't have those feelings, where I have the opposite feelings, right? And saying to myself, if this was how Michigan State was handling it, would I be critical of Michigan State? And the answer is no. I think that this looks like, as much as we know, right? It's possible I'm wrong on this, but it looks like Michigan is handling it the exact way that I would expect any school to handle it if they went into this thinking, let's do the right thing.
Yeah. So the Attorney General piece of this, that was one of the, because they were calling to action. They were calling on the regents to act. I didn't know what that meant until yesterday, and they're calling for the Attorney General to get involved. Is there any indication about a plan, a desire to do that or not do that? Do you heard on those lines?
I mean, Jordan Acker, who's a regent, tweeted out something today that this was going to be an important, they say momentous, I don't know. I forget. I'm paraphrasing his tweet right now, but like it seems like there might be some sort of action today on Anderson. What that is, I don't know what it's going to be until it actually happens. Mm-hmm. Not quite that plugged in.
I hear you.
I mean, I know several regents, and I know people who talk to regents more often than I do, and they're legally not allowed to say anything. So anytime somebody is like, hey man, give me the, you know, give me the rundown or tell me off the record or anything, all they say is legally not allowed to say anything. So that's why, like, you know, they had the sign out there, Regents Refusing Justice. Like, I see that as that's how the system works, right? Like, the lawyer's job is to try to extract as much as they can for their clients. That's what they're there to do, and that's who they're serving. And the way to extract the most money from Michigan is to make the most hay. And Michigan invited this by having a scandal at their university. So this is what happens. You have to go through this because you had a scandal at the university. It doesn't mean that everything the lawyers are asking for, it doesn't mean that everything that they're framing it as is true, and that we have to full-throatedly support everything, but we do have to full-throatedly support the victims here, the survivors here, and say that, you know, their voices deserve to get heard. What they want deserves to be front and center in the conversation. And I think that on the whole, that these press conferences are good because of that, because we're hearing from these people directly, which is better than reading the report, even if it's some of the same information that was in the report. And we're also hearing some of the things that Wilmer Harrell left out of the report, and we can make our, we can think about it independently. We can say, okay, why wasn't that in the report? Well, does that line up with the timeline? Does that make sense with everything else that we knew? And so, you know, we're, as the public, our job is not to take sides. Our job is to try to understand what happened and try to understand how it cannot happen again, especially because we love this institution and we want to make sure this is not going to happen again.
Is it the case, though, that right now, anything that they do that is not in line with what, say, for instance, yesterday they said in a press conference, they're calling on the Regents to turn this over to the Attorney General's office. If they don't, if Michigan doesn't do that, is that now to be construed as, hey, they lack transparency? They aren't sensitive to the wants and the needs of the victims if this is what victims are asking them to do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I feel like it's a PR trap that, I mean, they are going to be asked to do things that might not make a lot of sense on the surface, and then there might accede to them simply because of that. You know, for me, there's the report out, there's a settlement fund, and we can go from there. And the timing of these press conferences, so that they start coming hot and heavy on the heels of the actual report being released, when knowledge about Robert Anderson has been out there for, what, 2 years now? It just kind of feels like, okay, we have the report out, we're going to have our day in court pretty soon, and now we're going to start banging the drum a lot. And I mean, as Seth said, you have to listen to the people who have been affected here and hear what they have to say. But, you know, once we start talking about procedural things that don't really seem to make a lot of sense on the surface, I don't necessarily feel like you're obligated to follow through with that. So, I mean, for me, I'd rather talk about how the university failed in this regard and how to fix it internally, which I think you're seeing some progress with, because now we know the names of these people and they are no longer with the university. You know, so there is a shift going on, and how can we assist that shift, and how can we make it so that people can report without fear of repercussions?
Gotcha. All right. So we're going to, how about this? We'll call this halftime, because it's hard to segue from something like that in segment. So we'll just take a break. And when we come back on the other side, we will talk about things much more trivial. So wait. So does this mean that you're Mark?
No, I think he's taking his 15 minutes.
I gotcha.
But these are his 15 minutes. Yeah.
All good. Gotcha. Hey, we like all me, you know, we like you too, Mark. I'm not discriminating against Marks here.
You just happened to not be in Atlanta in 2013, so he's talking about a different Mark.
Brian told someone that story.
I didn't tell anyone that story.
He said, hey, yeah, Brian told us that you showed up.
Hot mic!
Someone asked me about it in an interview. I was like, what? Brian told you that story? I can't grieve, man.
I was back to a hotel really late in the night.
I just saw you get out of a car and you seemed happy.
Oh, man. I can't. I, man, I hope they go to the. They're going to go to the Final Four with Juwan.
That well, was inexplicable. Sam, if they do, you just got to take me, okay?
I got you, man. Yeah, I got. Well, I should say I got you. It was Mark from Kalamazoo.
Wow,
caller on the show. Who? I tell you, Michigan fans, that week that was a ton of fun. Yes, all right, we are hearing good word for Doug in the visit, and it makes things very interesting because I think, my opinion, I'm not speaking for Michigan, I think there's a clear pecking order here. And so, you know, how is it going to work if the other guys that are higher in the pecking order want to wait a little while longer? What do you do? What do you do? Do you take the risk? Do you take the gamble and wait on them? Or do you go bird in the hand?
If it looks like Bradley is Michigan or UNC and it looks like Trimble is Michigan or UNC, that feels like a fairly good situation.
All right, guys, we're gonna about to come back on the radio here.
We are back here on the Michigan Insider Sports Talk 1050 WTKA, online at WTKA.com, MGO Blog Roundtable. My guys from MGO Blog, Brian Cook, Seth Fisher. And so we got word last week. I was down in Florida at IMG Academy, and I got a call from a guy here in state, one of the top trainers. One of his guys had just been up at Michigan or was still at Michigan and had turned in a lights out workout. He checked in at, I think, like 6'2 and a half, 213 pounds. He ran a sub 4.5 40, very fluid in drills, caught the ball, and it looks like Michigan's going to offer him. And this is the day after Ohio State had offered him. And I had missed that part because I was traveling all day Thursday. And Dalen Baldwin is the guy. Michigan offered the day after, and he didn't take long. I mean, he actually told him he was coming. I had to take a couple of days to get the announcement together. But he is officially in the fold. What do you guys make of Dalen Baldwin's game? What do you project his impact to be?
Better than I thought when I was like, oh, we got a guy, you know, from Jackson State. And then, wow, blocks really well downfield. I know that that's not usually the first thing you talk about with a receiver.
You're such a Michigan fan.
I know. But, I mean, that pops in this film. It pops a lot. And they made that a big part of the offense as the season continued. Because remember, he was new to them, too. He was at Morgan State and then transferred to them last year. Yeah. So I think they put him on the field originally as just kind of the X receiver, as you know, the other guy. And they had, I forget his name, but number 9 on the other side that they were kind of focused on originally. And as they saw what Baldwin could do, you put the ball in that guy's hands against some guys in the SWAC, and things happen really fast. So he's got speed. He has pretty good hands. I mean, he's got a couple one-handed catches in that highlight film. So, you know, those questions are answered. It's really kind of what we were hoping that Cornelius Johnson would look like at this point. And I'm not saying that he isn't, right? Like, we haven't seen enough of Cornelius yet. But he's that kind of body, that kind of speed for that body. And then the blocking is just, you know, he starts riding a cornerback, and that guy is gone. And there's a couple bubble screens there that look like there's nothing until he just plants a guy in the sideline, and all of a sudden there's a wide open space enough that you can dodge a safety and keep moving. And, like, I tried to score this. I tried to do like a quick little UFR like Brian does just to kind of get an idea of what he was. And then
can't
I published
do that. That's a highlight film.
Yeah. No, it wasn't a highlight film. I did it with one of the games. Oh, okay. The Grambling game. Yeah. And they were all like, I think he got like a +8 in blocking highlights when I was purposely trying to like lower the score because it was swack. So I think this guy's going to start. I think he's going to be an impact player. If he doesn't start it, he's going to be certainly part of the, you know, part of who's out there, because we only have one guy, Cornelius Johnson, who's anything like him.
And he's got 2 years, right?
Yeah. Might not use them both, he said.
Well, if he doesn't use them both, that's good news, probably, right?
Yeah. Take it. I'll take it.
Yeah, that means he blew up this year. But he, in looking at the scenarios, because he got the offer from Ohio State, and the interesting thing to me was, you know, his trainer was like, he's still looking at Central. And I paused for a minute. I'm like, what? Ohio State versus Central. But then I got, he saw the opportunity. to play, to be showcased, being better at Central. Obviously, there it can be a path to the pro. I mean, Central's had high profile. Antonio Brown, when he got handed off to Central from West Virginia, he went there and parlayed that into, you know, being drafted into the NFL. So it's possible. But what it said to me, and what made me kind of feel like he might see Michigan differently, is because at Ohio State, you got Chris Olave, who has established himself as a beast.
Yeah.
You got Garrett Wilson, who, you know, is a guy. There's a percentage of balls that those guys are guaranteed to get. Does not mean that Michigan doesn't have talent at receiver. They do, but it is not talent that has proven itself to the point where you say, hey, you know, 60% of our balls are going to these guy, to this guy, or to these two guys. There's just more room to carve out a bigger niche in Michigan's receiving core than there is Ohio State's.
Well, as Seth mentioned, Michigan has a very speed and space receiving core now with only one guy who looks at all like Baldwin, right? And that's Cornelius Johnson. They don't have a jump ball guy, really, unless Johnson comes through and becomes that. So there's definitely more room on this particular roster for a guy like him.
Yeah. So who does he – I sort of look at a man and I say, not to say he's going to have Nico's production, but I think he can bring some elements of that to this offense.
Nico is a tough one, because once you get into that Nico Funches zone, it's like that's like truly exceptional ability to go get a ball. I was thinking more in like the Darbo range. He's a little bit bigger, but you know, the reported 40 time is good. We'll see like how hand timed that is.
Hand time Nico.
I know. Hey, but like you know, I think a Darbo guy who's not the world's biggest burner, but is a big body and effective at using his ability to jump to go secure balls, then I think that's a good comparison. And I'm going to go close my door.
Right. Yeah, he gets behind guys, but you know, you got to do a competition comparison there, right? Like it's going to be a little bit harder to get behind those Big Ten corners, and some of them are going to be able to keep up. So, but like, the speed is not just his game, right? He's got a lot of that Junior Hemingway, where just like the way he catches it, he knows where he's going with the ball afterwards, and he doesn't miss on the catch, but actually like positions his body to do something afterwards. And you know, Hemingway was not the fastest guy in the world. I don't think he was even in the 4.6s, right? But the way that he got yards after catch was that he positioned his body. He had like great body control to be ready to move after he got the ball. And Baldwin's always doing that a lot better than a lot of the Big Ten receivers that I've scouted.
All right, so let's switch gears here real quick. I'll ask Brian just briefly, have you watched any tape of Walter Nolan?
No, I have not.
Walter Nolan. So you're like Seth, you're like, you just refuse to,
you know, it's like when, you know, Beeline was recruiting guys and he'd have a 5-star on the hook and you're like, you know what? I'm going to watch that if he commits, you know, just not going to do that to myself.
He's a freaking problem. He is as impressive as Rashawn Gary was in a camp setting. It was all raw athleticism. Not much for technique with him. He was able to dominate with that because he's that much of a freak athlete. This kid has technique too. And it's like, man, you got some things in your favor. You got family in the area. And NIL, I mean, I feel even stronger now. We've had this discussion before. Like, what is the significance of NIL? What is it going to mean for Michigan? And I, talking to his dad, one of the things that he mentioned outright that they are going to be paying very close attention to is Michigan's NIL presentation. I mean, they're aware of the different laws in the different states. So how does it work in Georgia versus how it works in Florida versus how it's going to work in Michigan? They're very interested in those details. That says nothing about what we have come to know as the bag, right? The bag that is always offered in the SEC says nothing about that. But at least from the standpoint of NIL, Michigan can compete and can compete in a very, very serious way. So I think with a great NIL presentation, it boosts their chances. Not to the point where I would call them the favorite. I think the South is the odds on favorite still, but I mean,
come on, man.
You talk to them, man. You talk to them. I think they're serious. I think they're sincere in how strongly they're looking at Michigan. I mean, they came up, or they just came up. Like, they've been in Michigan now for a couple of days already. Now, granted, they came up to see family. They stopped by Ohio State on the way, but they've been here. They came up a couple of months ago and been around the campus. So he's been in Ann Arbor this week already.
You know what you should do? You know what you should do, Sam, is if you come in second for one of these guys, that you should get, like, you know, a couple weeks. Right? Like if you were, like, the second choice of a Walter Nolan and he goes to Alabama because that's where these guys go, you should get to borrow him for, like, a week against Ohio State or something. Like, you should get something for being number two.
You know what I found hilarious, though? So there was the rumor that he was committed to Florida, right? He was a silent commit to Florida. So there are some guys down there that cover Bama, they cover Georgia, and they were like, you know, those coaching staffs were like, hell yeah, man, he committed to Florida. And they were like that because none of those guys respect Florida's recruiting. So they were like, if he'll commit to Florida, then we're really going to get this guy now, because we're way better than them. Those guys can't recruit worth a damn. So they just totally dismissed and discounted the significance of even the possibility of a commitment to Florida. They treated it like it was nothing. So I took that to mean, look, it's going to be LSU. It's going to be Bama. Those are maybe Georgia, but LSU and Bama mainly. If you can somehow, some way overcome that with NIL, then you get them.
You know what they should do? Every year, all the college football bloggers for every team, right, get together and run this charity bowl. And then, like, you sign, like, your school, and then, like, you use, like, you know, your favorite score to kind of show, you know. Anyway, they should go and look at the charity bowl and show these recruits how much money each one of these schools raise versus each other, and just make that comparison, because that's a really good sampling, I think, of, like, where all of college football fans are and where their money is. And then, like, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but if you look at the comparison between how much Michigan fans raise versus how much any of these other schools raise, that should be the number. That's the only scientific number we have to really show how much money these fans are willing to put towards something.
And you also have to count Slippery Rock's number, because
yes.
get bored in the charity bowl when they're up by so much that they put Slippery Rock in the top 10.
Right. You also have to, right. Don't just look at it and think, okay, Slippery Rock is better than Michigan State at this. All right. Like, there's some nuance to it.
Yeah, it's fine. Do you guys think we get to 2022 without a federal law or without an NCAA NIL rule?
So I don't know. I don't know if the NCAA can come up with a rule that actually, like, complies with all the state rules at this point. So I think federal intervention or nothing. And then you've got this, like, sort of one-upsmanship where any NIL restrictions will be seen as verboten. And so maybe that is the best option, because we're seeing Southern states kind of go one by one and being like, no, our law is more permissive. Our law, you don't even have to go to college. You can just get money from anything, for anywhere. It's called the economy. So I feel like whatever happens, we'll either have a federal preemption or all the state laws will kind of converge on a very permissive model.
I thought the way, at least, wasn't the way the law was written in Michigan, that it was, if the NCAA came up with a rule that
meets certain. Yeah, I haven't read the law in a year, and because it got thrown into committee for a while and it was going through the process. But I believe Michigan's law is mostly just restrictive of the NCAA. It's not laying out. It was fairly simple. It was saying the NCAA cannot restrict these guys' access to commerce, which was the main thrust of it. And I think keeping these things as simple as possible, the NCAA doesn't want them simple as possible, because that's gonna get that their end game is, we don't want to be in a court with them fighting over TV money. That's the that's the nightmare scenario for them, right? So and that's going to be part of it, because name, image, likeness, well, you're on television and that's your name and image. So they want to be able to constrict the television rights to their scholarships and the room and board and all, and the stipends and all the stuff that they get. And I think that's what the ultimate end game is going to be, that they're going to get that. And then everything else is going to be, you cannot restrict commerce. The details of it are being hashed out. The problem with expecting a federal law to happen is I don't think people understand how Washington works. Right? Like, they all agree on something, let's do this. It's not how things actually go. These things move when somebody's got an advantage or somebody can needs it or whatever. So, you know, there needs to be...
Well, there are certain pieces of legislation that do get passed. So they just made Juneteenth a federal holiday. So
yeah.
And that seems like something that seems fairly bipartisan at this point, and so does putting up a middle finger to the NCAA. So we have a lot of different competing bills, and I think what the issue is like, what are they going to settle on is the one they actually want to drive forward. And
yeah, Ira said during we were talking earlier, so Juneteenth is a federal holiday, but you can't teach about Juneteenth. Makes a whole lot of sense, right? It makes a ton of sense, doesn't it? I just say, hey, look, you can't get off in the weeds there. Can't get off in the weeds there. We'll bring it back to talking about the latest example of Juwan Howard being a candidate. Did you guys see this?
Oh, where was it?
The Washington Wizards. The Washington Wizards. See, remember, he's a former Bullet, right, Mr. Weintraub?
It's his alma mater. Juwan Howard. They even wrote a song that included, "That's the reason I'm a Bullet fan," and you heard the thing. It's funny to see, and you guys probably can see the same reaction. I just see it, I laugh now. But as soon as they say Scottie Brooks and the Wizards don't agree to a contract extension, I'm like, I can't wait to see this list. And immediately, even though Juwan last week said, I'm not going anywhere, immediately all the people in D.C. that I know are like, yeah, Juwan's got to be the top of the list. And, of course, the Michigan fans then jump into those comments and go, he's not going anywhere. And then it just kind of devolves from there. But it's just right. Funny.
Well, so like, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Washington Wizards job is not a plum NBA destination.
No, it would not be somewhere that I would go. I look at it now at this point. I want his name to pop up on all these because he has adamantly said he's not going anywhere. So now it's purely a good recruiting thing. Coach is hired by the NBA, but he's not leaving.
I mean, something happened similar with Jim Harbaugh's first couple of years here where he was just on every list by default because the reporters for the pros didn't respect the ability of a college team to retain him in any way whatsoever. And like,
well, and certain guys he was recruiting against whose names rhyme with Frames Janklin were repeatedly telling recruits that Harbaugh was going to the NFL any day.
Right. So I will start having an iota of worry when there are no people named Howard in a Michigan jersey. Like,
right
there. That's when I'll start like taking any of this remotely seriously.
Okay, so but here's the thing, all right, and this track record has something to do with it, right? But you guys are open to really looking at all the five stars Juwan is recruiting, right? So I assume you watched Jairus Walker film and Jalen Duren film and.
No, not Duren.
Not Duren. We're getting not Duren. That's not happening.
Nope.
He's going. I mean, he's reclassifying, going pro, and leaving. Like, there's just no way. He's going to Miami, yeah. and he's going pro, and he's reclassifying. It's just not. There's hurdles.
The line in the sand has gone up way high, but like, I didn't watch any Jalen Duren.
All right. So what about Jairus Walker? The grown man playing a high school game right now. At one point, he was talking about Michigan being in his top three. I think I mentioned this earlier. I just hadn't seen praise be quite as prevalent for Michigan among his list. Are you guys seeing or hearing anything different along those lines?
No, and that kind of feels like a recruitment that's going in a different direction for whatever reason. I mean, he is a grown-ass man, as you mentioned, yeah. And like it's... Like, is he a four? Like, I mean, I don't know if he really has is he a college five? I don't know. He's not
He looks
tall.
Like a micro Will to me.
Like, I mean, he's a guy who I have trouble fitting into a college roster in my brain just because I have beeline brain. And I'm like, okay, your four is Isaiah Livers, right? Like, so the idea of a guy with like a 74 offensive rebound rate just dunking on people doesn't compute in my mind as something that you can have at the four. Although maybe Brandon Johns will start reconfiguring that in my head. But, you know, for me, like, that is the luxury spot in this year's class. You need a center. You need a point guard. Jet Howard is coming. And then you've got at least one more spot, and that's pretty much just the gravy spot.
Okay. So what do you guys think of Donovan Clingan?
I mean, if he doesn't see what Hunter Dickinson's doing and come to Michigan, then I don't want him because he ain't smart enough. But if he does, then he looks like Dickinson 2.0. And, you know, not quite as refined in his body, but that's what people thought about Dickinson before he arrived at Michigan. Exactly. So there's still time there. And I don't think he's quite as, like, skilled as a passer and a shooter, but, like, as a back-to-the-basket guy who's going to be able to post up and be efficient down there, very, very similar.
Yeah, his outside shot is actually part of his game a little bit at this point, too, which was, you know, that's something we've been talking about, but yeah.
Dickinson was kind of in the same boat, right?
Yeah.
Just kind of, like, I see it a little bit more with Dickinson just because he's got that, you know, free throw percentage that he's established at the college level, and he's got that elbow jumper that is already an effective shot, and you, like, you know, I haven't seen full game on Clingan, so you don't really know about, like, what he looks like when he's taken a shot that misses.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part.
So we did the exercise last week talking about the point guard scenario. Doug McDaniel, someone asked earlier in this hour on the video stream, said, hey, are there any good vibes with Doug McDaniel? There are great vibes with Doug McDaniel. Thing, there have been great vibes with all of these guys, right? Are they stronger with Doug McDaniel? And we keep getting the question. So how do you process it? What do you do if your higher pecking order guys are, and by my assessment, your higher pecking order guys want to take a little more time? And you know, both of these guys, both Seth Trimble and Jaden Bradley, are going to be summer decisions, right? And Seth Trimble, its timeline is probably, just by the tone, sounds like it could be sooner. Sounds like it's going to be July. So if you're Michigan, do you go Burden? Let's say Doug McDaniel wants to come now, and the other two aren't deciding until July at the earliest. Do you go Burden the hand, or do you take the risk?
I'm going to take the risk because, one, Michigan has Frankie Collins in the previous class, right? So Doug and Frankie are fairly similar players. And Frankie's probably a long-term college player. So if you don't actually end up getting Doug, it's probably not a complete disaster if you strike out on all three of these guys. And also, if you're looking at what Trimble's looking at, he seems to be looking at mostly UNC or Michigan. Mm-hmm. Jaden Bradley seems to be looking at mostly UNC or Michigan. And those guys aren't going to the same school. So I'm going to roll the dice here and see if you can shake one of those two guys out. And also, like, a month is not a long time to wait for McDaniel. Like, right? Like, if he really wants Michigan and he's really ready to commit now, I think that it's likely that he's ready to wait for a month or two. I mean, this isn't going to push into the late signing period where he's going to worry if he has a spot somewhere, right? Like, the timeline here is such that I think you can, you know, kind of have your gamble and still have your backup plan if that is in fact what the pecking order is. As we mentioned, this is just speculation from some dudes on the internet. It's not right. What the coaches are telling anybody.
Right.
So, yeah, I'm rolling the dice.
Seth?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an easy call. I mean, I like Doug's game a lot more than other people. You know, a lot of people see that guy and be like, that dude's 5'8". What are we even talking about, right? Like, what's John Howard looking at 5'8 guys for? Because you can get that guy in the portal, right? Like, you can find a guy, usually playing the Sun Belt or something, who is, you know, was too small to get recruited and just knows how to run the floor. And you can find that guy if you need him later. You also, I mean, Doug's looking at Arizona State, Virginia Tech. Like, if you get in the situation where, you know, down the line you lose one of these other guys, you really can't call Doug back and be like, hey man, I know, you know, things weren't great where we left it. I know that these guys are going to be honest with them, right? He knows who's visiting. He knows where he is in the pecking order. They've got to be telling these guys exactly where they are, and they know their timelines, and you can't push these guys to have any faster timelines. July is a really fast timeline for the level of recruit that these guys are. So I think that, you know, I definitely take the I definitely take it. And even if you do lose Doug because of it and don't end up with any of these guys, you can get that guy in the portal.
Yeah, I just feel like with Juwan, I'm more willing to take the I think you can gamble with your Juwan Howard. I think he's going to get his share of these guys, win his share of these battles with your North Carolinas of the world. I mean, because you know, that would what would be what would intimidate you into maybe saying I'm going to go bird in the hand, because you got to beat Carolina by and large. And I think they can. I think there are some advantages in the Trimble recruitment that we laid out before. I think that, you know, Big Bro didn't have a great time at UNC. Right. Hubert Davis has to prove that he can do what Juwan Howard is doing, lead a program. Right. And then Jaden Bradley, there were a lot of people who had Michigan on the outside looking in for Jaden Bradley. And they were like, no, we just don't talk a lot. we just don't offer a lot of we don't offer much of a window into what we're thinking and doing. But Michigan has always been right there. And if you came away from that weekend thinking anything else, then I don't think you're paying attention, because I didn't realize Jaden and Jet were as close as they are. And Jet he's doing his recruiting thing as if we should be shocked or surprised, right? He's doing a heck of a job recruiting this guy, feeling like they can carry on what they do in high school at the college level is a thing. Loves the system, as Dad said, it's a perfect fit what they do at Michigan, but they're doing their due diligence with the visits thing. It is, but they're in such a promising position that you just feel like if you just wait, if you just hold out, you got a better than average, a better than 50-50 shot of getting that guy. And when you talk about, like you said, Brian, if it's mostly between Michigan and North Carolina for those two, then you got a better than 50% shot of landing one of them. I'm like, hey, man, roll the dice if you're Juwan Howard. I'm right there with you. So now big. So we talked a little bit about big recruiting, talked a little bit about guard recruiting. They are hitting 2023 on the offer trail a little heavier now. And it's a guy I wonder if you watch. He's a five-star, so that might offend your sensibilities a little bit. But have you guys watched J.J. Taylor?
I have not watched J.J. Taylor yet.
Watch J.J.
That's a little bit. Watch J.J. Taylor.
Watch J.J. Right. Taylor. He plays for Mac Urban Fire.
Oh, yes, this guy, yeah. Yeah, I haven't watched him, but yeah.
Yeah, very, very. So he's 6'9". He's about 210 pounds. He can, well, maybe that's being a little generous. Maybe 195 pounds. Can handle it, can shoot it. You know, a plus passer. I mean, the guy checks all the boxes. He's the number 7 player nationally in 2023. And the dude could not stop gushing about how much he loves Juwan. I love Juwan Howard. That's my guy. That's my dude. He's from Chicago. And so I told my guys down at Speece, I said, talk to his coach. They talked to his coach, and he said, oh, yeah. No, that was my high school point guard. That's my teammate. And so his AAU coach is Juwan Howard's teammate. This is a five-star I think qualifies for you guys to watch.
All right. Well, you know, after Musa Diabate and Caleb Houston, the range is broader. Like. It's just like the guy who it's like, yes, this guy is going to the G League. I'm not going to watch. Like,
if I was an Alabama fan, I'd be watching all these five. I'd be watching Walter Nolan's film too. I know how Michigan football recruitments tend to go. Michigan basketball recruitments tend to go other ways, right?
Hey, Michigan recruiting fans have a recruiting version of PTSD, and I get it. I understand it.
There's no need for a recruiting qualifier there. Michigan fans, Michigan football fans have PTSD.
There is no happiness in life. There is only a mirage on the horizon. Yes. Is that Putin yesterday, or is that a Michigan football fan?
Well, Michigan sports. I saw it on my timeline an awful lot. So
that doesn't specify if it was from Putin or if it was from Michigan. Because if you see it in your timeline, it could be either.
Hey, well, hey, look, maybe they'll get some good news here in the next month or so. That'll, you know, get people on a more positive note, be it certainly in basketball. You can expect that. In football, you can hope for that.
Here's my problem with 2023 five stars. I watched this guy's film now, and then I watched the film for 2 years, and then he's on the court, and then he's on Michigan's team, and then I got another 5 months before he can play. And then he plays for 5 months, and he's gone. I just spent 3 years watching this guy's film for 5 months of Michigan basketball.
What else? What else are you going to do, Seth? Go rock climbing?
That is kind of what we do. We kind of like watch film, right?
We are old dads. This is what we do.
All right, fellas, it's been we were heavy at the beginning, we were light at the end. We appreciate you guys staying with us all the way through. MGoBlog roundtables are always insightful, most of the time fun, but always insightful. So I appreciate you guys joining us and appreciate you guys watching and listening. We'll be back next week with the MGoBlog roundtable. We'll be back tomorrow here on the Michigan Insider on Sports Talk 1050 WTK, the ticket, the official voice of University of Michigan Sports Ann Arbor, a Cumulus station.